Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Rest is History with me, Tom Holland. Sitting opposite me is the ever lovely Dominic Sambrook.
Oh, you're very kind, Tom.
Dominic, last week we were talking about greatness.
Missed myself out.
So I guess a complete lack of modesty is an essential attribute of greatness.
But
aside from yourself, I mean, we went through a lot of great people last week. In the intervening week, have you come up with any great people?
I have, because you see, we didn't talk about writers, musicians. We didn't talk about Shakespeare or Mozart or the Beatles. So actually, it's not just about... We were wrong. It's not just about killing people and scoring goals. It's also about, you know... Well, that's a whole podcast in itself, isn't it?
Okay, so Elvis, the Beatles, they'd be great. Okay, well, today I thought that we could talk about Civil War.
Nice.
Not a cheery topic.
Jolly subject.
Prompted specifically by an amazing poll I saw.
You saw because I gave it to you.
Yeah, it's sitting right here in front of me. In which Americans who identify as Democrat or Republican, it says one in three now believe that violence could be justified to advance their party's political goals. And this year in America, we've seen kind of armed militias starting to roam the street. I mean, it's... What's the difference between a fraying of civil order and full-scale collapse into civil war? What are the lessons of history on that? If you're about to collapse into civil war...
Yeah, do you know when it's coming?
Yeah, do you know when it's coming? So what would you say what are the lessons of history there on that?
Oh, easy subject. See, this is something that's always fascinated me, because I can remember going to university at about the point when the Yugoslav civil wars were kicking off. And Yugoslavia was a country that had existed throughout my entire childhood. You know, football team, anthem,
Olympics,
flag.
Winter Olympics.
The Winter Olympics in 1984.
Torvaldin
in Sarajevo, I think it was. So, you know, Yugoslavia was a sort of fixed point in the atlas. You know, you learnt that Belgrade was the capital. People went on package holidays in the 80s. It was a very trendy kind of package tour destination.
And then it implodes.
And then it fell apart in that incredibly gruesome way. I mean, any listeners of our age will remember, you know, neighbour turning on neighbour because of religious differences, because one was a Bosnian Muslim family and one was a Bosnian Serb family. And that sort of terrifying sense that everything can just fall apart... You know, almost sort of J.G. Ballard.
I mean,
nightmare can become real so quickly.
I mean, and so it's the fact that it's happening in a European, modern European state.
Yeah, I mean, that's terrible to say so, but that's obviously part of the impact, isn't it? That it was so close.
But I guess, I mean, one thing that strikes me about the way that Yugoslavia implodes is that it was a kind of it was an artificial nation.
Yeah, but all nations
that had been
are artificial,
stitched
aren't
together.
They?
Yeah. But it was stitched together from the constituent parts of the Austro-Hungarian
and Ottoman
and the Ottoman Empire. So these empires that had collapsed. And then in a sense, after the Second World War, although it wasn't officially part of the Warsaw Pact, it was part of the communist sphere of influence.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it was kind of frozen by the Cold War. And it's when the Berlin Wall comes down and the Cold War, you know, ends... that the ice melts and all these kind of ancient hatreds have been busy incubating.
I don't agree with that. I don't think it is ancient hatreds. That was an argument. Ancient hatreds was actually a phrase used in the 1990s in the White House by the Clinton administration to justify not intervening. They said, it's all these ancient hatreds of these people who are all basically tribesmen who hate each other.
What do you think causes it?
I think it's, you know, you look at all these civil wars, you look at Spain in the 1930s, even if you look at England in the 1640s. And the patterns are not so different. You see this sort of escalation of rhetoric, this belief that the other side pose a mortal threat to the health of the nation and to you and your community. There's often a sort of religious
dimension. I think it's down to Diocletian.
Diocletian?
Yeah.
Roman Emperor.
Diocletian, the Roman Emperor at the end of the 3rd century, who effectively
divides
the Roman Empire in two. So you have the Western half and you have the Eastern half. You have Orthodox and you have the Catholic. And the fracture line is mapped exactly onto the...
This is Yugoslavia.
Yeah, yeah.
I throw that
into the mix. But you see, I think also another place where you mentioned the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah.
And, of course, the country that has been most savagely torn to pieces by civil war over the past decade is Syria.
Yeah.
And you've had civil war as well in Iraq. And I think there's a sense that... again, both countries are kind of artificial entities stitched together out of the tatters of what had been the Ottoman Empire. But there is a case for saying that civil wars get incubated in nation states that perhaps previously had been part of imperial frameworks in which the idea of the nation state made no sense at all.
But that's okay, I can buy that a little bit. So you've got these sort of what you call artificial creations, where they're sort of baked in with these differences. But then you look at Spain in the 1930s. So Spain is a country with centuries of history. Of course, there are separatist movements in Spain in the 30s, but Spain was a sort of plausible, reasonable nation state. And even in areas with no separatism, people still killed their neighbours. I mean, I remember reading a book about 3 or 4 years ago, which made a massive impression on me, called The Spanish Holocaust by Paul Preston. And basically, the argument of this book was that what happened in Spain, the dehumanisation of the opposition and the belief that killing them was a moral thing to do, was not so different from what happened in Central and Eastern Europe, 4 or 5 years later under Nazism. And actually, the individual stories, I mean, there's one village I remember where the landowner and his friends basically round up all the people in the village who he doesn't like, and they get them to, they do a sort of mock bullfight with them, get them to run around the stadium, and then they butcher them, they kill them all. And this sort of thing happened in village after village, town after town, where there were no religious differences other than Catholics and atheists.
Hatred kind of grows exponentially, doesn't it?
Well, that's the terrifying thing, though, isn't it?
And
see, we think we're immune.
Well...
Do we? Well, that's the interesting question, because we've lived through a period in Britain where political differences have been very, very highly charged. And we are living in a time when, on social media, people regularly say that their opponents are evil, they are purely malign, they're motivated only by greed or hatred and all the rest of it. I mean, the left will say that, the right and the right of the left, completely happily. And those are the preconditions for conflict. Because if you really do believe that your opponents are not properly human, then why wouldn't you kill them?
I suppose the reason that it hasn't is that everyone's too busy. Everyone who thinks that is too busy on Twitter actually to get out on the streets.
Right. Yeah.
But of course, I mean, we have had a civil war within the United Kingdom, if not in Great Britain, because we've effectively Northern Ireland was in the 70s.
Northern Ireland
was a scene of effectively of civil war.
It basically was a civil war. So in the early 1970s, you have hundreds of people being killed in Belfast every year. You have bombs going off. I mean, at one point, I think in about 1972, you basically have a bomb going off in Belfast every single day. So you're going to the shops, you're going to work, you have to go past military checkpoints. There are soldiers everywhere. There are tanks. There are armed paramilitaries in the streets. I mean, that's as close to a civil war as the United Kingdom has been since the 17th century.
I mean, the thing that's kind of interesting and depressing about that is that what causes the sectarian tensions in Northern Ireland are a legacy of the violence and the hatred and the conflict that spread across the whole of Great Britain and Ireland in the 17th century.
Yeah.
So in a sense, it's been an enduring legacy of...
Well, I don't know if you'll agree with this, but people always say, and particularly sort of very well-meaning sort of teachers, people of that sort of denomination will say, you know, if only we understood history, if only we knew a bit more history, we'd be so kind to each other and it would be really nice. And yet in every war that we've spoken about, particularly Yugoslavia and Northern Ireland, it is history that is in some part the culprit. It's because people have such a strong sense of history.
Yes, maybe if people knew less history. I think that's true. And I think it's it's when identities that are rooted in religion or in an idea of nationhood rub up against equally strongly held ones that you get it. And I suppose that's what happens in Spain in the 30s, is that thrown into that mix is kind of ideological tensions bred specifically of the 20th century that then kind of fuse with much older religious and national identities.
But you were asking at the beginning about is there a point at which you see the alarm bells ring? Can you see an alarm bell ring? You can hear an alarm bell ring. Is there a point at which you can hear the alarm bell ringing? And I wonder what that point is, because often, you know, let's say Britain in the 80s, which I've written about, the rhetoric was incredibly impassioned, routinely, you know, tens of thousands of people.
To the Battle of Orgreave.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got the miners' strike in 1984-85, where you've got miners and police sort of having a pitched, albeit sort of not fully armed, battle.
But the ranks of the police with the shields.
Sort of the police horses charging the miners. Yeah. You know, the police would then say, well, we've confiscated these weapons, the sort of makeshift weapons that pickets have brought. So both, there was obviously violence on both sides, and people would talk about it as a sort of, you know, as an unacknowledged civil war. Now, it wasn't a civil war, because people didn't kill each other and there's no great death toll, but the passions are not so different. And obviously at that point, the alarm bells were going off, because people were, you know, in the newspapers, people were saying, this is a terrible situation. You know, are we sliding towards something more serious? The government must get a grip. The government mustn't inflame things, as Mrs. Thatcher was perceived to have done.
And you probably, isn't it true that in France, over the issue of Algeria, whether Algeria should,
yeah, you know,
which was part of metropolitan France, but de Gaulle then kind of cut it loose.
Yes.
Isn't it? I mean, that's the kind of the plot of the Day of the Jackal.
Well, the generals tried to. There was a coup in Algiers. What date are we talking about? I think about 1961, if I remember right. I might be wrong. There was a coup in Algiers, which was then part of France, the capital of Algeria. The generals tried to. They thought they would use this as a springboard to take over France itself and to basically impose a military regime that would keep Algeria part of France. And there was this moment when, you know, could it have come to armed conflict? I mean, it didn't, because the generals lost.
Well,
their
I mean,
nerve
did, how close did it come?
I don't think it
probably
did actually
not.
Come
I mean,
very
kind
close.
Of on level with.
But you know, what's interesting is that a few years later, in 1968, you know, everyone of a certain age will know what I mean when I talk about the événement of 1968, the kind of riots in the streets of Paris and students throwing cobblestones at the police and car factories on strike and all the rest of it. And de Gaulle famously disappears. He flies off to the French military base in Baden-Baden in West Germany to basically get the loyalty of the army, because he thinks he's going to have to come back with the army to fight a civil war to retain his position. So as recently as that,
yeah,
France was a country where the idea of a civil war
was possible,
was embedded.
Was conceivable.
I mean, you've been occupied by the Germans, you've had Vichy, you've had the resistance, you've had the liberation. Why wouldn't you have a civil war 20 years later?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I suppose in answer to your question about do you know when civil wars are going to start, going right back, I suppose the most famous example of that would be Julius Caesar crossing the Rubicon, which, you know, crossing the Rubicon has become...
Yes. So what's the significance of that? You're not allowed... A general is not allowed to cross the river.
So you push things you push things back far enough, and what happens in kind of the ancient states of Greece and of Rome is that it invariably comes down to personal ambition, and that's absolutely the case with Caesar.
Yeah.
Is that he's been off in Gaul for 10 years, beating up Asterix and everyone like that, and feels that you know, he is entitled to be treated with great honour and respect. The problem is that his achievements and the way that he obtained his governorship has created so many enemies back in Rome that he has people who are desperate to destroy him, and they want to destroy him legally. So the moment Caesar lays down his command, he becomes a private citizen, and then he can be prosecuted and hopefully, you know, from the point of view of his enemies, ruined. So what Caesar wants is to go seamlessly from being governor of Gaul to becoming consul, with no point become being a private citizen. And his enemies kind of maneuver him into a situation where he has the choice of laying down his command and going back being a private citizen, risking ruin, or keeping hold of his command and crossing the Rubicon, which is the boundary between his province and Italy.
But that's quite
different. And the moment he does that, then effectively he's declaring civil war.
But that's
war.
Different from the examples we've talked about before, because that's generated by the ambitions of one man, not by...
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Except, of course, that the reason that Caesar is able to command troops and loyalty is that he's tapping into mass resentment.
Okay, the resentment is there, it's kind of latent.
Yes, but I think that Caesar is kind of an example of someone who... I suppose without Caesar, maybe the Republic would have fallen apart anyway. But it's, you know, he's definitely the driver of that civil war. Whereas with the more modern civil wars that we're talking about, the sense that this is like a kind of cancer in the body politic.
Yeah, but they have drivers too, though. See, they have drivers too. That goes back to the ancient hatreds thing. So Yugoslavia wouldn't have happened. I mean, there might have been some conflict, but it wouldn't have been the same if it hadn't been for Slobodan Milosevic, who was the leader of the Serbs, deliberately inflaming the situation by saying that Serbs were being persecuted in these sort of breakaway republics. And then the leaders of some of these other republics firing up their own base at the same time and saying, we must take up arms, we must arm our police, we must be free of the Serb, blah, 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 blah. So basically people are deliberately pouring petrol on the flames.
Isn't that just a very, very, very weaponized version of what's been happening in, say, British politics recently?
Well, this is the question, isn't it? Is it? Because obviously...
Well, I don't know. I mean, you're the modern historian. Tell me.
Well, I mean, what I was thinking about was that
Milosevic, who fires up his base and it all implodes and it results in civil war. I mean...
How is that different
That's the model.
Yeah. How is that different from any other politician? I mean, you're right that actually, now arguably, a more sort of unsettling question is, you know, is democratic politics itself a kind of...
aberration.
A failed experiment. No, is it a sort of sublimated version of a civil war? And does it have the germ of civil war in it? So in other words, if you have two parties screaming at each other across a chamber and they say to each other, you know, you are betraying the nation, you are greedy, you are only interested in yourselves, you are failing, people are dying because of you. I mean, we hear this now all the time.
So in the British context, it isn't the fact that we have the idea of Her Majesty's loyal opposition.
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
Is that not a legacy of the civil wars?
Because you need the opposition. Because the process.
It's not just the civil wars that precede the Cromwellian protectorate. I mean, wars, violence, unrest persist throughout Britain and Ireland for decades to come. I mean, really, right up to Culloden, I suppose you could say. Mm. And the experience of that, the understanding of where factions within the body politic that refuse to acknowledge the legitimacy of those who are opposing them can lead is a lesson that kind of burns itself into the fabric of England and Scotland.
I think
certainly.
You're right, and I think that what happened... You see, my theory, I was always... We did the English Civil War A-level, and I was always fascinated by the fact that, you know, we stopped... I think with maybe... We went into Charles II, and then we sort of stopped after the Glorious Revolution, I think. So we sort of did... You know, from James I to William of Orange, and I was always interested what happened next, because all these guys who've been killing each other all this time, and why do they suddenly start just going to coffee houses and talking about the South Sea Bubble and reading Gulliver's Travels? why aren't they still fighting each other? Because the issues are still there. And clearly, what happened was that the wars had been utterly traumatic, and the people basically stopped resorting to violence, as that in a way British politics became slightly more de-weaponized.
Yeah.
So, you know, in just before the English Civil War broke out in 1642, Charles I's chief minister, the Earl of Strafford, had been executed after an act passed by Parliament. So he'd been, you know, he was condemned for basically doing his master's bidding. And an execution, impeachments and execution were kind of political, reasonable political tools. There's obviously a point later on where you just stop executing your opponents. You know, no one executed Gordon Brown in 2010 or David Cameron in 2015. I mean, it would be, they weren't even exiled. So there was a point...
I suppose Cameron was kind of exiled to his shed, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
His posh shed.
He was. He's living a kind of...
Yeah, but you'd rather be exiled to a posh shed than have your head chopped off.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what life's like in David Cameron's shed. I mean, I don't actually live very far away from David Cameron, so I could easily find out.
Well, yes, go and do that next week and report back.
Extraordinary laziness that I have.
It's the idea. I mean, and I suppose that's what's so unsettling about that idea of the poll of Democrats and Republicans thinking about is that a functioning democracy depends on extremes acknowledging the legitimacy of the
pluralism, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's pluralism.
Yeah, and unless you have that, then you don't really have a functioning democracy.
But there were times politically, certainly in modern political history, where that pluralism frays. I think so. If you say we talked about the 80s. If you go to the 80s, there was a point there where, to some extent, both sides denied the other's legitimacy. You know, one of Margaret Thatcher's sort of defining qualities was that she basically didn't say socialists are wrong. She said they are evil. They are their forces of wickedness. And equally, her opponent said of her, she's not just wrong. She's not pursuing just wrong policies. She is a genuine evil person.
Yes, but at no point do Thatcher or Kinnock deny the right of the other one to stand up in the House of Commons.
No.
And, you know,
they don't start importing arms to distribute at their party conference.
But, you know, Prime Minister's Question Time, Thatcher stands there and Kinnock questions her as the duly elected Prime Minister.
Yeah, you're right.
And likewise, Thatcher takes questions from Kinnock as the duly elected leader of the Labour Party. And the kind of the fraying is there on the kind of the hard left of Labour, where there are people who deny the legitimacy of bourgeois democracy, and on the right, where there are people who kind of fantasize about coups and military takeovers. And that's always, as long as those two extremes are kept on the extremes, then you have a functioning democracy. Once they start kind of
But we're in a more dangerous time now, aren't we? Because the sort of the mainstream of democracy is more discredited than it ever has been in our lifetimes. I mean, trust in democracy is lower among young people, particularly who are the people always most likely to drive a civil war, because they're young and they're kind of active and they're, you know, they don't have a mortgage.
So well, and also, I mean, famously, one of the drivers of if not civil wars, then mass civil unrest is. Graduates who don't get jobs.
Yes, which is precisely where we're heading.
And we'll have further civil unrest after this break.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp.
Bottling everything up is never a good idea. It can have terrible consequences. For instance, look at all the conflicts throughout history. I wonder how many of them could have been solved if they just talked things out.
And Tom, I have a confession for our listeners. As you know, I've been really struggling with anxiety about the massive series that we've got coming on The Rest is History, all the prep we have to do for that series on the French Revolution, the First World War. I mean, it's all mounting up, isn't it? And when we talked it out, I felt so much better now that I got all those crippling anxieties and insecurities off my chest.
If you want to talk, you can always talk to me. But if not, then I highly recommend therapy. It can help you learn positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. Therapy isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. It empowers you, Dominic, to be the best version of yourself.
If you want to give therapy a try, why not check out BetterHelp? It's entirely online, it's convenient and flexible, and it's really easy to get started. You just fill out a brief questionnaire and they'll match you with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp.
Visit betterhelp.com/restishistory today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/restishistory.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, Was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Caddy, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Go back to America, which is where we started. I think what's worrying about that, as opposed to Britain, is the number of weapons. I mean, that's what you need to have a civil war. So basically, the English Civil War starts because both sides want to get their hands on weapons and they want to get their hands on the army, the king and parliament. In the US, in Northern Ireland, they could kill each other because they had weapons. They had imported guns. In the US, they have guns already. I mean, we've all seen the footage of sort of people during the Black Lives Matter protests standing on their front doorsteps with their, you know, semi-automatic rifles. Don't you find that worrying?
Yeah, I generally find the idea of people having lots of guns worrying, but that's because I'm a very English wuss. So, yeah, slightly nervous about that.
And you've got sort of Donald Trump, you know, doing his best to delegitimize the election result before it happens as well. That sense of
So essentially, you have to respect the legitimacy of
the process
of elections and the process. And if when you don't, that's when the risk is, I guess.
And do you think? I mean, I know you have strong views about things like the future of the United Kingdom. Do you think it's ever plausible you could have a kind of civil war in the UK itself, for example, if part of it tried to break away?
I can't imagine that if it's the will of the Scottish people to leave the UK, that a UK government would oppose that.
The people of Northumberland won't take up arms to compel their neighbours to...
There's a reason why England and Scotland joined, which was that...
Money.
Yeah, well, money, but also, it was money for the Scots, and it was a desire to kind of protect the northern frontier for the English. And it'd be interesting to see whether, you know, the factors that influenced the joining of the United Kingdom, whether they would recur if the UK came apart. I mean, I don't know, but I wouldn't worry about that so much. I think one of the things that when you think about say the civil wars in Britain in the 17th century or indeed the American Civil War is that your sense of why a war is being fought must evolve over time, and indeed it retrospectively. So with the American Civil War being the classic example that now we think of it as having been fought about slavery, but there's a sense in which that wasn't...
I don't know, it was always about slavery, wasn't it?
I don't know if it was very...
You're going to say it was about the right of secession of the southern states.
Well, I think in its fundamentals it was about slavery, but I'm wondering whether it was seen as having been about slavery by people who were fighting at the time. How long, you know, was that a kind of idea that
evolved
over the process of fighting? And likewise, in the civil war in Britain, the understanding of what people were fighting about, yeah, I would guess, was pretty different at the beginning of the wars.
Because at the beginning, I don't think anyone was fighting. I mean, obviously, the English Civil War is a great example where the meaning changes. So at the beginning, nobody is fighting to get rid of the king.
Yeah.
And certainly nobody is fighting for a republic. But at the end of the war, people think that Charles Stuart is the man of blood,
yeah,
and he has to be killed. And there are proper Republicans in the army who then, for the next 10 years, are fighting any attempt at what they see as sort of backtrack on the radical vision that has taken root among the soldiers. So I think that's one of the things that often happens in a civil war as opposed to another war, I think, is that you have a very engaged...
Unintended consequences.
Yeah, and you have a very engaged kind of rank and file because they're fighting on home soil, they're fighting for hearth and home, they're fighting against their neighbours. It all just means much more.
Yeah.
And then they become radicalised over time.
And I think that to that extent, you could say that the tensions that have afflicted Britain over this decade, kind of the same thing has happened. That things have happened that people, yes, would not have anticipated.
Yeah.
That perhaps the Brexit vote has unleashed.
Well, I think
arguments and tensions and crises.
Didn't they?
Yeah.
But it was a de-weaponized.
Yeah, thankfully.
Conflict.
Thankfully. But you can kind of see that civil wars mutate ideologically.
Yeah, they do. But also, I think, Tom, one of the disturbing things about them is that, you know, Brexit is a good example, actually, because there you have an issue that, you know, everybody has an opinion, but most people probably don't have an intensely strong opinion. That, yeah, a lot of the shouting is done by a relative minority. But that's true in civil wars too.
Yeah.
Most of the people, I mean, if you ever read interviews of people in the Yugoslavian civil war in the 1990s, or indeed in Spain in the 1930s, a large proportion of them would say, actually, I didn't want a war, I wasn't really that bothered. It was my neighbours who had always been incredibly political who drove this, and the rest of us were sort of swept up in it. And that's the scary thing.
I mean, in the English civil war, I was identified with the club men.
So tell us about the clubmen.
Well, so the club, because I grew up in Wiltshire, and the clubmen were very strong in Wiltshire. They were people who basically didn't want to fight on either side.
So they fight both.
So they would get clubs, hence their name, and they would go and retreat and live in a forest. So I was kind of thinking, you know, in the heat of the Brexit disagreements, thinking I quite fancy being a clubman, just retreating from all the debate, going living in a wood.
Living in the wood,
and kind of wondering, well, you know, what would it take to precipitate an actual civil war in a modern Western liberal democracy?
Question.
You know, is it the definition of living in a Western liberal democracy that it can't go? You know,
no,
it can't
impose
a civil war.
Of course, it can happen. So how would it work? Well, I suppose it would be preceded by a period, let's say 10 years, possibly longer, of growing passion, intense politicisation. This is why I think apathy is so underrated.
Yes.
Because the more, you know, if you ever want to find, yes, somewhere where everyone cares about politics, they're talking about politics, you know, which is what sort of politicised people want,
yeah,
that place is Spain, 1934.
Yes.
You don't want to be there.
Happy the land that takes no interest in politics.
Right, exactly. So I think you have an intensely politicised public. You have... young people, so the people who most like to fight, basically have young people who are on the streets, who maybe don't have jobs.
Yeah, who feel that they are not getting the jobs that,
yeah,
their education.
They've got nothing to lose. I think you have a sense of sort of dehumanisation or delegitimisation. So your opponents are not just wrong; they're evil, and the process itself is worthless and flawed. So there's no point in persisting with it.
I mean, I think there is the way that Trump has been trying to argue that he's not going to leave. That's a kind of major step, but it's kind of there on the left as well.
Which, I mean,
the
you look at America right now.
Because the question, you know, if Trump wins, would
Democrats,
people opposed to him, accept it? I mean, I can't imagine they would either.
At what point, if you're the governor of California, do you just say, sod it? You know, we're off.
Secede.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. But I think the other issue is, you know, to have a war, you have to be able to kill people. So you either have to have paramilitaries with access to weapons, so they're getting them from outside, so the intervention of some foreign powers, or you have a very politicised military. So in other words, the army will step in and will fight on one side. Well, there are elements of it that might fight on different
sides. But I mean, I have to say that all of these conditions are clearly, but I'm relieved to think that they are all pretty unlikely. So,
well, some of them are. I mean, I think in Britain, for example, the one that is the least likely is actually probably the military. In the 70s, there was talk of this happening.
Yes, Mountbatten, wasn't it?
Mountbatten and his coup. So Lord Mountbatten supposedly was going to lead a coup to install a government. No, it wasn't true.
But it was in The Crown.
It must be true. So the most famous story is that Cecil Harmsworth King, who was basically the boss of the Daily Mirror, he summoned Mountbatten. He used to keep in his desk, this is the late 60s, he used to keep in his desk a list of his cabinet when he became emergency prime minister, which is an unusual thing for a newspaper. I mean, maybe it's not. Maybe all newspaper workers do this. I'm sure we can all think of newspaper editors who probably do have lists in their desks of their government when they assume supreme power. But anyway, Cecil King had this list, and Mountbatten was on it, and he basically arranged a lunch with Mountbatten in which he said, here's the story, I want you to take over as dictator and the Daily Mirror will support you. And Mountbatten sort of was, you know, he didn't know what to make of it. He basically didn't make anything of it. I think he went back to the Queen Mother and said, I've just had the most extraordinary conversation with a friend of yours. And it was never really mentioned again. But when the Mirror found out about it, they basically booted out Cecil King.
Fair enough,
as their chairman.
I think if your chairman is plotting civil war, I think that's fairly reasonable.
Well, it was risky. I mean, if he'd succeeded, they would all have been for the chop, presumably, or maybe exiled to the Isle of Man or something. But anyway, there were stories that in the 70s, this would be discussed at Sandhurst and whatnot. You know, what will happen if people come to us and they say, we need to step in. You know, the trade unions are taking power and we need to arrest all the leaders of the TUC and the Labour Party or something. And generally, as far as I understand, the mood was, this is ridiculous. We wouldn't have anything to do with it. And I think Britain is in a relatively fortunate position of having a relatively unpoliticised military that's hard to imagine taking part. But the United States is slightly different. I mean, if you're there, you've got the president is the commander-in-chief. The president gives you an order, you have to follow it.
Yeah.
Or you're breaking, you know, the chain of command. So imagine that the election in the US. I mean, in the US, a lot of those conditions have been met, haven't they? There is the delegitimizing of the process. There is already violence on the streets. There are a lot of guns. There are people who genuinely believe that their opponents are evil and are out to get them and are going to steal all their money or kill their kids or all this kind of business. Imagine a situation which is an electoral deadlock. The president, as commander-in-chief, refuses to leave, gives the army a direct order. You know, governors give their police forces different orders.
Dominic, I thought that we'd end on this note because it would be a kind of cheery note. Because I in no way thought that you'd go full...
We haven't even gone into France yet.
Full civil war. But it's still, you know, let's end on a positive note. Very unlikely, isn't it?
But is it, though?
Well, yes.
So I don't know. I mean, how long...
I think...
Let's say we've both got, how many years left? Let's be optimistic. We've got 30, 40 years left when we're still until we're dragged off to the great archive in the sky. In that time, is it plausible that we will see some sort of breakdown of order, some kind of violence in an industrialized, as it were, in inverted commas, developed country?
I'd have thought so, but I wouldn't have thought
we
that
will,
it,
won't
I,
we?
I wouldn't
I mean, it's implausible to say
I,
we won't.
I wouldn't have thought that it would be a kind of traditional civil war. I think it's likely to be prompted by climate emergency.
See, I think civil wars have been a constant of human history.
I'm hearing your gloomy Spenglerian pessimism.
The difference in
them
and conventional
pessimism.
Wars, right, is that a conventional war becomes less and less likely because the stakes are so high, so the technology is so...
So, yes, okay. So,
but a civil war, I mean, you're not going to drop a nuclear bomb on somebody, but butchering your neighbour with a kitchen knife, I mean, that's perfectly
possible. Well, I suppose, I suppose what I can see is something akin to Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
So ulsterisation. Just never a kind of an open civil war, but just bombings,
paramilitaries on the streets of Luxembourg.
Well, I think on that note, I think we have nowhere to go after that. So we will draw a line on that, which I think it's not been a cheery conversation.
No, I think listeners should tweet us and suggest their own favourite.
Tweet us and say why Dominic's wrong. Cheer me up. on that somber note, we will bid you...
have a lovely day.
Bid you farewell.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.